It's not because they're not.
Okay, everyone, it's 6 o'clock, so if you can start it. Okay, so welcome to the first Greetings Commission meeting of 2020. So please note this meeting will be recorded and the sound recording subsequently made available via the council's website. In addition, please be advised under the openness of local government bodies regulations 2014 that other people may film, record, tweet or work from this meeting. The use of any images or sound recordings is not under the council's control. If you have any questions about this arrangement, please speak to the Democratic Services Officer who is in the stream meeting. Okay, if we get started. So just a quick housekeeping, we've got quite a lot on the agenda today. So if we can keep our questions and answers as well as these kind of focused as we can, just so that we can get through everything on the agenda. And if you can just make sure that everything gets directed through the chair. So if we start with item number one, is apologies.
We've had apologies from Councillor Morgan and also Alison Simmons.
Thank you. As we go through the minutes of the previous meeting, has everyone read the minutes? And is everybody happy? Just minutes. Are you happy with the minutes from the last meeting? Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
And the ladies.
Yep, that's agreed. Thank you. So item three, declarations of pecuniary and personal interests. You got any?
No.
What's it? No, Jeff? No. None there, thank you. And item four, declarations of the party whip.
No.
Nothing there.
Sorry, Chair, don't members of who sat on the budget panel need to declare an interest?
Well, that's good.
Been there.
I wonder if it was my money.
Item five, so questions under scrutiny committee procedures. No questions were submitted. Item six, the pre-decision scrutiny of any specific financial matters to be considered by Cabinet. We haven't got any this evening. So item seven, so Cabinet items for pre-decision scrutiny. Now we're just going to rejig the format here slightly. So what you might have on your agenda is part D, the Chalmers grants. We're actually going to swap D and A over, so we're going to start with the grants first. Okay, can we pass over to Councillor Taylor?
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for swapping the agenda around for me so I can get
off. That's no problem.
Okay, the report sets out proposals for strategic partner funding for the next 2 years, starting on the 1st of April 2020. The Council previously undertook a full review and agreed its strategic partners in 2018. The current two-level service level agreements with strategic partners are coming to an end in March 2020. All partners, with the exception of Chalmers 2020, were invited again to apply for funding for a further 2 years period to assess whether they are still meeting the expectations of the strategic partners grant scheme and meeting the Council's aims and objectives. Each strategic partner has an allocated officer who goes out and meets with the organisation on a regular basis to discuss progress against the objectives in the SLA. Chalmers 2020 previously the grants panel that due to a reduction in the level of service they are providing within Chalmers, that they no longer feel that they meet the criteria for being a strategic partner and therefore withdrawn as a strategic partner. In addition, the Council's Voluntary and Community Sector Development Officer has been working with Rosebery Community Centre on their business plan, and as a result they have decided not to reapply to be a strategic partner going forward. The report sets out the assessment criteria used to assess the strategic partner applications. All applications are assessed individually and then moderated by the grants panel, and the resulting scores are set out in detail in the report. In addition, this year all strategic partners were invited in to present their application to the grants panel, which gave an opportunity for the panel to ask further questions. Strategic partners are expected to demonstrate organisational robustness and governance arrangements. They are a viable, sustainable organisation, have a 2-year business plan which demonstrates effective financial management and sustainability, and they can deliver against a minimum of 5 of the Council's strategic objectives. The report sets out the recommended strategic partner grants and the amounts to be awarded. The report sets out specific recommendations with regard to Syston Volunteer Centre along with the associated reasons. And in addition, Citizens Advice Bureau previously received a separate annual grant to deliver specialist money management and debt advice work. And it's been decided that going forward this will be amalgamated with their strategic partner grant and will be awarded for 2 years. There is an additional budget of up to £28,500 to afford this element of work, and discussions with regard to a final amount are still currently ongoing. Officers continue to work with strategic partners to strengthen governance, build organisational capacity, develop business plans, including looking at income generation and other external funding. The high school's achieved is further evidence of the continued role of these organisations as strategic partners.
Thanks for everything. Okay, if I open that up, has anyone got any questions? Councillor Draycott?
Yes, thank you, Chair. If I've read the report correctly, the reductions are quite small, and I think that's very good in view of the financial situation the council is in. Just one question about the process. So there's like 2 years, that's now completed almost. So are the strategic partners informed what the new figure will be for the next 2 years, and then they put their bid for that figure? Is that how it works? Or that you're nodding, so I think...
I can clarify the process. Strategic partners are given an indicative amount, they can bid up to that, and they obviously need to be able to demonstrate the need for that level of funding.
Right.
The level of funding that they're getting for next year is the same as they're getting this year, so there is no reductions at all. So it is based on the same level that they are getting, and it is the same amount for a 2 year period.
All right, because when I looked at last year's report, when it was January 18, and that was for 2 years, 18-19 and 19-20. So if you take, for example, Clockwork Credit Union, we're proposing 8,298 for next year and 8,298 again for the following year. But they got £8,000 2018-19, and the same again, plus 1%.
The amount in there is exactly the same amount that they're getting this year.
So it's gone from 8,000 in 2018-19 to 8,000 plus 1% in 2019-20.
So that makes it 8,298, which is how much they're getting paid this year, and the proposal is they get back next year.
Right, thank you.
Any further questions? Councillor Parsons.
Just a point of clarity, really. They're all termed strategic partners. And I don't have any issue with the services and the funding. I just want to make sure that we're clear, and I'm presuming they align with the overall corporate strategy at some point, and it just would be nice to have the bit of the corporate strategy which each strategic grant aligns to highlighted, unless I've missed that.
So in Appendix 2, there's a table which sets out in terms of...
Can you just give me a page number, sorry?
Cabinet report.
222, I think it is.
222.
Okay.
So there's a table which sets out
the better. Yeah, I've got it. Okay, that's all I wanted. Thank you. I'm good. It's getting smaller as my eyes.
I've just got one question. Obviously, these are the partners that we've been working with, and obviously they've reapplied. Are there any sectors of the community that we're not supporting? And do we proactively go out and search for people who may not know to look for us?
So in terms of the grant span, it's quite wide ranging. We're aware of those organisations that we fund or we work with that are working in the borough. We ask ourselves the question on a regular basis, is there anybody else that we think should be a strategic partner? And that's always a difficult one because there's only a set amount of budget, therefore that has to go further if you don't. But in the past, we have had people like 2020 that we recognise. Obviously, they're now not going to be more going forward. And we have had a Clockwise as a strategic partner as well, recognising the ongoing work that they're doing in the borough at a strategic level. So we do constantly ask that question, but it is difficult within the envelope of that. But then we also do promote the other grant schemes that we've got as well.
Just that, obviously, we opened up with the members' grants, so obviously that's enabled us to help a lot more within the community with the members' grants. But what we do with them, we don't just give them money and leave them, and they're worked with constantly over the year to become more self-sufficient, so they don't have to rely on us, so that then opens us up to be able to support other organisations within the borough.
So what I was going to say is also there is restrictions within what else they can apply for. So for some groups, like we work really closely with a children's sort of distraction activity group, Go Getter, and they get more funding by not being a strategic partner. What we could give them would be capped, and therefore they can apply if they have new projects and things. So in some cases where an organisation has been identified, it's not always...
This is necessarily the right direction.
Yeah. So when we first identified strategic partners, it was based on the number of applications that are coming to us every year, and decided it's a lot of work for them to constantly apply for things with the unknown. And if we gave them a strategic partner grant for two years, it gives them stability and they can carry on delivering, which is what we wanted. So we do review where we can, but it's not always appropriate.
Yeah, lovely. Thank you. Oh, Councillor Barton?
Yeah, in my ward, which is Shelthorpe, there is a brand new community centre, as you may be aware. That formally opened on the 15th of December, so it really is brand new. Is there any way that that would be eligible to apply for any of this? I'm not expecting a yes or no answer, obviously.
I mean, obviously, we've proactively worked with Gorscover and worked with them in terms of both their capital funding application and their revenue funding application, and we have given them capital. In relation to the ARC, we have worked with them on their capital bid, and they have had a community facilities grant, and they have had some revenue grant from
so
the
Charter Grant.
So they are in touch.
Yeah.
We were all there.
I was meeting a greeting with all three of them. Okay, thank you.
They are going to they are going to generate quite a bit of income for themselves with the space that they've got there and things they're going to say. It's just because it's like you say, it's so new. It's you just watch this space, see how they cope going forward.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Other question? Okay, if we just go through the recommendations then. So are we happy to support the strategic partners grants as existed in the document?
Thank you.
That this proposal with its four recommendations is finally being presented for consideration. I support each of the recommendations made and would emphasise the importance of the reasons as stated, particularly the implementation of additional and selective licensing. I would like to make some brief comments on the policy justification and the previous decisions, as a number of committee members may not be aware, as you're new to the council, may not be aware of the considerable work that has been undertaken to get us this far by the various councillors and the work that Alan Slum has undertaken, particularly recently. I wrote the scoping document in 2013, and the committee in 2014 made 15 recommendations to Cabinet, which added to the work of a previous scrutiny panel's success in 2009, where they put forward 5 recommendations, so 19 recommendations, or 20 recommendations. On that first one in 2009, the Article 4 direction was established, and that came into force in 2012 for the 20% threshold. But equally, the important point was that self-regulation by landlords was introduced but as time has gone on, we've realised that's only partially effective. So hence the second scrutiny panel that took place in 2014. One of the key recommendations of the 15, of the recommendations of those 15 that was made, was the appointment of Professor Smith and a PhD research student to investigate the effect of HMOs, particularly students on the borough, on Loughborough itself, but borough-wide, and also to cleanse our database to provide appropriate statistics for the planning department and, of course, the private rented sector. He was appointed in July 2015 for 3 years, and a summary of his report is online. There was also a presentation to councillors at that time. We decided at that stage that accreditation, that's also mentioned, was not an appropriate way forward, and I'm not going to go into any of that unless you have questions. I'm happy to address any questions you have, as Alison isn't here, and I'm sure Paul and Eileen are here as well. But if you have any questions on the 15 recommendations, that's the summary of it in that folder, and Professor Darren Smith's report. So I think we can perhaps answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Lovely, thank you. Can we move on to questions? We'd like to go first. Councillor Jacob.
Yes, thank you, Chair. As has been said, 2014 was a long time ago, and finally it would appear that we're getting somewhere. Two points I'd like to make. One regarding page 30 and 31, the risk management charts. Landlords legally challenge the decision-making process and not enough resources to complete the scheme. Other councils have done this and have been doing it for quite a while. So why do we see the risk as being so high when other councils have gone down that route already? And my second point I'd like to make is I see Leamington and Hastings Ward have been chosen. I can't say the report was very easy to read, and it was only when I got to page 118 that I saw that Hastings and Leamington Ward are being proposed. I'd like a little bit more information about why. But my final point is that those maps, certainly for Hastings Ward, are not correct. And I don't know about Leamington, but the Hastings Ward boundary is not correct. You've got a chunk of Southfields in there as well, I think. So they're just the comments I'd like to make, Chair.
Addressing your last point first, there's no requirement that it actually has to follow ward boundaries, and in fact quite a few councils just pick the correct areas rather than sticking to wards. So as this goes on, I'm sure we hopefully will be able to extend the area, but those in our view was the most pressing areas that needed to be dealt with. Your point about risk is that there have been a number of legal challenges to licensing, and Margaret and I have somewhat laboriously gone through all of them, and virtually every single one of them is to do with the consultation process and where mistakes are made, and that seems to be the area where landlords think that they are able to stop the process. And some councils have made silly mistakes. On one consultation process, the link on the website would actually link to the documents, so nobody could actually see what they were talking about, and that was upheld, that legal challenge. So there is a risk. If we don't get it right, there's a risk. But after the consultation process, I think it's legally relatively downhill.
Okay, can I just say then, instead of referring to the maps as wards, it should be areas?
No, it can be, I said. You're suggesting wards, and I accept that.
At the moment, on 116, page 116, it's referred to, and you've got the maps, then it's a ward and
then it's
a ward.
Yeah.
They are not the boundaries for those wards. Okay. That's the point I'm making.
You can take that one.
Yeah, if you pick that up.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Councillor Smithwick, just picking up as well on the risk. As Paul has said, we have looked at the whole national picture, and many of the places that were challenged, I think I found one that was totally refused. I can't remember if it's a London area. But they reviewed it, did it again, and got through. So, you know, it's, I think they chanced their arms, some of them. And Nottingham did as well, way back. But then it got through. I think landlords, well, we don't know what they'll do. I would say there's fairly little likelihood. I mean, one of us, our biggest landlord and agent, actually had a half page spread in the Echo saying how much he would like to have licensing, so that some of the really real rogues were brought to task. Interestingly, we knew a little bit more about his background than, at the time, than the Echo printed. I have had a letter from another very respectable landlord with quite a few properties, actually delighted that we were enforcing as we were enforcing, and he said he would be more than happy to support licensing, providing when we found an individual that wasn't towing the line, that we would levy the appropriate civil penalty. So yes, there is a risk, but I think equally most of them have been delighted that we can invoke the civil penalties and get the real undercover landlords and bring them to task.
Okay, I've just got a couple of questions. One just picks up on Councillor Jacob just talking about other local authorities. Do we know roughly how many other local authorities have done this before? We've got evidence of
the actual licensing.
Yeah,
well over 75, and there are more going through.
So we 75 authorities.
Yes.
Yeah.
But equally, I think it's recognised that we're quite a unique borough, in that we're a market town with a university, and we've now become almost a university with a market town as it's grown. So we're competing with big cities as well, with almost as many students. So it does put us in quite a different category.
Yeah. My other question is to do with the cost of the licensing. While I think it's a good idea that we should be trying to improve the housing stock in the borough, I'm wondering whether having a blanket cost for everybody is necessarily the right approach, because there's going to be quite a lot of good landlords out there who've got properties in good repair, who in those particular areas where we're doing selective, where we're actually going full private sector, that there'll be good properties, they're not currently having to pay the licence fee, and then they're going to have to, whereas they're paying the same amount as the rogue landlord as such, that we're looking to help improve those properties. And it doesn't seem right to me that we're charging the same amount, but there could be significantly more work to be done for the properties where there are issues and potentially safety problems, and whether we could look at a scheme where if they go in and it's an inspection and it passes first time, where they get a reduction, almost a little bit like the single occupancy on council tax, where they're using less of the council services, therefore we give them a slight reduction. It doesn't seem quite right to me that it's a blanket charge for everybody.
I haven't discussed this with Councillor Mercer, obviously. I think so far we've tried to work with landlords. Mm-hmm. And we put on an awful lot of forums that gave them the full opportunity to come. The thing about selective is we're looking, yes, at every property. Mm-hmm. But many of those properties are the ones that have never been looked at. So we don't know what we're going to find when we go in. It might need a lot of work, it might be brilliant. But the few that I've been into in those wards have been very worrying. So they do need a lot of work.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting that we wouldn't go in. I'm suggesting that when we go in and there's nothing wrong with it, that they then have a reduced cost compared to the ones where you go in and there are actions.
I don't disagree with you, but I think it's the next stage.
Yeah, if I may, yeah. Chair, I think the cost of the licence is related to administering the application, yeah, and the initial inspection. Mm-hmm. So those costs effectively will be all the same for whoever. Understandably, taking your point, there will be properties that come into
the licensing regime under the schemes that aren't already in. But we do have to recover, we are able to recover our costs, otherwise some people would be subsidising that cost, if you like, because that is the cost of actually administering the application process, going through that process and doing that inspection for all landlords.
So why then isn't the cost higher for when we're having to go back in and do re-inspections following actions?
So what I was going to say is, so things that we're looking at as part of the scheme, there's a range of tools that you can use to remedy that. So the enforcement of the actions, we can do that in a number of ways. So there's opportunities to look at length of licences, for example. So if you do have to revisit it because there's a particular condition, you can issue a shorter licence. So there are things that we haven't fleshed out yet in terms of developing the scheme. And what that would do is, if you go in somewhere and you're able to give a five-year licence, you probably won't have to go back again, and that will cover the whole.
I just think somewhere within the policy there needs to be a way of incentivising the good landlords.
Yeah. So there are a number of schemes that do have different lengths of licence depending on what is found. We are looking at whether or not that would be appropriate. What this report is about is the public consultation stage of the scheme. So it's about, do we have enough evidence to support the fact that there may be conditions in the private sector that we should be looking at more closely in relation to licensing? Once we've gone out through the public consultation, the next stage will be developing the full scheme, and that's when we'll be looking at, have we got the right cost for each license? Can we incentivise? Is there a way that we can look at exactly that issue that you're talking about? We have recognised that already in the service, so we are wrestling with those things, because obviously we want the scheme to be successful, we want landlords to welcome it, and those good landlords should be able to then promote their properties by saying, we are registered and we've got a licence application approved. So there are benefits for the landlord as well.
Thank you. And can I just say as well, in relation to this, when there's a deadline given that all the paperwork has to be submitted, there'll be the good landlords will have it there on the day. It's the others who will need the inspections. And we've got up to 30,000 now. If they don't comply, there are heavy penalties. So the standards of properties should improve as time goes on.
Yeah. Councillor Baines?
A couple of questions, if I may. The first is around, what do we expect to get back from the consultation? What obviously a consultation is there to test the policy, but what do we think might come back from this? And the second question is around capacity. Are we sure we've got the capacity to undertake all these evaluations? To what extent will it test the resources that we've got?
On the first one, it's a legal requirement under the Act that we quote take reasonable steps to consult. And because the previous legal challenges have largely centred on the consultation process, I think that's why Alison has put so much effort on consultation. And one minor amendment which will be happening before it goes to Cabinet is, we'll be saying, a budget of up to £30,000. Because my view is we've perhaps been a little bit too much in terms of looking at different mechanisms for consultation. A lot of those councils that have implemented these schemes have simply done online surveys and perhaps the odd workshop, nothing like as rigorous as we're suggesting. And so with a mind to save a bit of money. What do you get from the consultation process? Well, what you get is hopefully, if there's any ideas that we miss, then they'll be suggested. If there's a lot of discontent about the way in which we're implementing it, then we can take that on board. But I'm quite keen on, I know consultation is often an automated process and people ignore the result, but I'm quite keen on the concept.
And again, to pick up on the point Paul's made, where it says the resources to run a successful scheme are more than forecasted, as yet we don't have any evidence And I would be sort of saying, well, what evidence do we have already? Because it says landlords and additional staff required to work on the issues raised if we don't have cooperation from them, or we expect the cooperation from them, or they don't get the licence, basically. Mm. So that was one, had Alison been here, unfortunate circumstances, we would have teased out a little bit more. But I think it's more important tonight that we get it through to take to the next stage, quite frankly.
Councillor Parsons?
I, if you'll indulge, Chair, I have two or three points, if I may.
Yeah, sure.
The first one is just a general point about the paper. I sense this is close to the end of a very, very extended process in trying to achieve licensing. And I would ask everyone to be aware all we're being asked to do tonight is actually pass 30,000 of final consultation. And we've seen an awful lot of evidence that there's been real anecdotal evidence in abundance on this issue. Mm-hmm. I would suggest to members that we don't normally get a paper with quite as much red on in the risk profile. And that's, it doesn't actually worry me on this particular occasion, partly because I'm slightly, something where it's happened 75 times across the country. I am not aware, and why would I be, it's not my subject area, but I'm not completely aware of anyone running to me telling me that of the 75, 74 have blown up, gone bankrupt, it's been dreadful and sort of terrible experience. So I'm slightly wary why we have such a red report in front of us, when one would deem from the evidence of 75 other councils, it perhaps hasn't been quite such a risky journey. So I've just asked members to bear that in mind when looking at the overall paper. I have a couple of other just slightly more detailed points. I presume we have a problem when I look on page 63. I'm looking at paper, I'm really sorry, I'm philistine when it comes to being able to work with the screens and reference things in other papers as quickly. Only 7.4% of non-licensable HMOs inspected past the dash standard. Now I'm sure the dash standard is higher, but when only 7.4% of what we inspect, well not we, but with dash inspect, I think that should make us aware we have issues. And again, I don't think, again, there's any lack of evidence that what we're doing is the right direction of travel. I'd ask two specific points. It's not really facetious, it's the common phrase that occurs in the Act. If I just use one version of it, the Act permits additional licensing where the local authority believes that a significant proportion of HMOs are being managed efficiently and effectively, giving rise to problems for residents or the general public. The paragraph below it, problems for the occupants or members of the public. I'd like to know if there's anyone shouting about what level those problems need to be at before we actually do something. I know in my own ward, which borders the university, and there are issues. So I'm just intrigued to know that there's going to be no barrier put in front of us about the level of problems before it becomes something we can do, because that's a phrase that's referenced a number of times. The second point I'd like more detail on, perhaps not now, but when we get to the final stage of this, is the escalation process for non-compliance. In other areas of this council, we take a very, and I think in certain areas quite rightly, gentle process of escalation for certain issues. And I think in some cases that's very warranted, that we have a very gentle escalation process. For example, removing someone from a house is a very serious issue, and we escalate those issues, I think, probably appropriately. I'd be interested to know what the escalation is going to look like on this when someone is not compliant, and whether we're going to take perhaps a slightly more positive and aggressive stance in terms of the escalation when we see non-compliance, and I presume those steps will be laid out when we see this finally. My very final point, in amongst all those points, this has to work for us financially. It's highlighted as one of the risks about resources for running a successful scheme. It will cross my path at some point when it hits budget, assuming I stay around and in the world of budgets, assuming I stay alive, Chair, which is always a dodgy issue most of the time. And we need to make this work, and I would suggest work effectively and at least commercially sensibly for our benefit. And I see no reason why it shouldn't do. If we put that together properly, so there's a number of points in there. I'm very sorry for those number of points, but because we're getting all in one go, I'm very happy to hear any points or this when those things will appear.
I can answer some of them. Unfortunately, there's some detail that I think only Alison would be able to answer. So we can get her to jot down some of these answers in more detail for members if they wish. In terms of the level of problems, the reason why we've gone to the degree of going through, when you look at this report and the detail that we've got, and the actual going into properties to inspect them, is to be able to support us in relation to meeting the requirements of the legislation. So, as all things, the legislation doesn't define levels, it's significant and reasonable and all those other words that we often see in legislation. So what we wanted to do was make sure that the information that we've got is evidence that will support the implementation of a scheme, and that's what we think we've got now. So all of the information in relation to the various standards, the numbers of issues that we've identified, we think there is sufficient in there to support the introduction and implementation of the scheme. So I think we're reasonably optimistic about that in relation to meeting the requirements of the legislation. In terms of the escalation process, we do have a corporate enforcement policy, and Councillor Parsons is quite right, it is an incremental approach, and we do build up. We try to work with people who across all the council, people who don't comply. We do our approaches to work with them positively to gain compliance, rather than go straight for enforcement action. We find that works better in a lot of cases. We will be looking closely at the enforcement process as part of the implementation, because clearly once you've got a scheme, if you identify failures against the licence conditions or failure to comply with application process, then you do need to have enforcement conditions that make the licensing scheme work. So we are aware that there will be a need to look particularly at the licensing scheme and whether or not the escalation process that we currently have is going to be swift enough, because we do want people to comply with the application process. And in order to do that, I think we can't just let them say, oh yeah, it'll be as and when or whatever. So there will probably be a different route depending on the severity of the case, which I think will be helpful. And I think the last one on finances, again, the next report to Cabinet, which details the schemes, will have fully worked through financial costs of both the application process and the potential enforcement issues that might ensue.
I'm sure on that basis, Chair, that we undoubtedly, I'm sure you would pick it up, I'm sure others would hear, but I think it's easy if we just answer it and put on the work programme.
Yeah, definitely.
That it returns here in detail. I wouldn't wish anyone to miss it.
What I was going to say was that not every borough does approaches this in exactly the same way. Some are right in there with the fine.
As far as enforcement.
Immediately. But there is a procedure. I do think if you go into a house and there's something that you do see wrong, there has to be a short period of time that they have to put it right, depending on whether it's a Category 1 or a Category... So those hazards and the civil penalties that apply to them have got to be clearly stated on the database or on the website, and I think we already have that up. However, some councils do go back in and they will fine or charge for a repeat visit. But I think one of the key things to remember is if we do find a place that should have been licensed and they've been earning a considerable amount of money in rent, we can also retain the proceeds of crime on top of everything else. So it's civil penalties, there is proceeds of crime, so it doesn't pay a landlord to really try dodging all of this. I've done some inquiring on the what other council who already have licensing for a while, and one that's not too far from here has 17 enforcement issues that they're taking forward, which are going to reap an awful lot of money. We could be losing out on that if we don't enforce rigidly. So, but I think the processes towards enforcement, sometimes certain processes can be combined to cut the time. And that's what I would hope, and it's what I've discussed with the officers.
Thank you.
Could I just add, yeah. We're not doing this because we don't like landlords.
No, not
it's
at all.
The Vice Chancellor of the University on several occasions has said, I really think you need to do this because I'm concerned we're going to lose students in a fire, and there was a fire quite recently and one of the landlords got prosecuted for it. As students move into these better quality flats in Loughborough, then it's freeing up these houses, and quite often migrants are going in there who don't know how to complain, and we've come across some in disgusting conditions. But some landlords, one of the big landlords in Loughborough, I went to him about some noisy tenants, and he just said to me, quote, I'm here to make money and I don't care what you say or think, full stop. Well, you know, there's one or two landlords that perhaps fall into other categories.
If I may just want one more comment, and I'm sure I don't want to teach you the subject, and I have no idea as to the legality of it, but it seems to me that if there is any financial doubt around the programme, I doubt there will be, I would suggest we're probably quite viable to charge a one-off deposit similar to something to be paid on entry to the scheme, which when the house leaves the HMO register, you can get back. And that would provide a significant amount of cash in the first tranche of this scheme to finance setup costs, and then it's returnable when a house leaves the HMO scheme. It's only an idea because I have a commercial view of the world and a budget view of the world. I don't know whether it's legal or not, but it seems to me that I do it on a number of things where you pay a one-off cost on entry to the scheme and you get that back on exit from the scheme. If you have your house for 10 years, you pay £1,000 up front as well as your five-year licence fee, and on exit in the scheme you get your £1,000 back. But that's a way of generating a large sum of money to finance the setup costs without, and it's going to get returned.
I think we'd have to look at that, Chair. I'm not sure.
I don't know the legality of it, but it's
to take away and have a look at the
every student pays a deposit which they hope to get back at the end of their year. Mm-hmm. And I don't see why we can't be the same. And that pays for setup costs.
Yeah. Councillor Bailey?
Just very quickly, one thing I didn't see in the report is which was alluded to there, is when houses do leave the scheme, is there a mechanism? Which again, I didn't see in the report, of making sure that they are doing what they said they were going to be doing, if that makes sense. So if they don't renew their licence after 5 years, for example, is there a mechanism by which we go and inspect and make sure that they are, there is a reason why they're not renewed?
If they're continuing after 5 years, they need to re-register.
No, but I'm saying there's those that drop off. That don't re-register and have legitimate reasons, but, you know, for whatever reason they're not re-registering, then is there a mechanism that we're checking that there is a legitimate reason that they're not re-registering?
I don't know of any that have actually de-registered.
Well, that was their free choice.
But so, I think what Councillor Bailey's picking up on is if you've got a house that's being rented out as a student property, and then that person says it's no longer a student property, so therefore I don't have to have it licensed, like I'm moving into it. Is that actually happening? Is that's kind of what you're saying?
Should
we
just
ensuring, like in, you know, 3 months time, is someone going in to check that isn't a student property anymore?
That they're just not renewing the licence just because they can't be bothered more than.
But once you've got planning permission for it to be an HMO, that property is worth an awful lot more, and therefore they would be loath to let that happen. So I suspect that it would be a very rare occurrence. But I take the point.
But in fact, there have been families that have gone in on an interim period. But how do we find out unless a councillor actually raises it and says, "Go and look at this property"?
I think that relates to the issue of enforcement again. So it could happen at any point. You know, if we implement a scheme that requires the landlords to register, we will have penalties for those who don't register. Obviously, we'll have intelligence around what we think. So the database has been mentioned. So we will have certain ways of checking against that. If people then say they're no longer a property that qualifies under the scheme, it would just revert to a normal enforcement issue. So if we then check and they are still renting it out, we can implement the enforcement. But it's like in any enforcement, you're reliant on the intelligence of finding the breach. So that's part of the issue of when you implement anything that requires people to do something, obviously the intelligence that we have to gather around how many we should have, how many do, where are the ones that don't, how we pursue those, that's all part of that process. So there will be, it's a movable feast, there will be things coming in and dropping out, but it will be down to our intelligence and how quickly, so as Councillor Smidovich goes, if people identify it to us, we'd be able to check. If we have lists and databases, we'll be able to check. But that's not to say that somebody who we don't know about won't be operating as a landlord.
I appreciate that. What I'm getting at is those that are less than scrupulous might just say, well, actually, it's another fee of this. I'll say it's used under a C3 rather than HMO, and then let it 6 months as a C3, and then 6 months later. So I think there needs to be some, if we've already got the data on that particular property in 5 years' time, there needs to be, I think, balance and check in place that makes this, if it drops off the database, for whatever reason, that it is a legitimate reason that it's dropped off. So we need to be more proactive rather than waiting for anecdotal evidence of, well, actually, it's now being reused as a... If we've already got that data, we should use that data to our advantage, not wait for anecdotal evidence, is what I'm getting at.
We can use the data, but these things could change daily. So you could go and inspect it the day after it drops off, and then 2 weeks later they might change it again. So it's a question of the degree to which, if we want to inspect everything that drops off, how many would we accept? We don't know. How long would we take to inspect them? What would the cost of that? Where would that go? So all of those issues would have to be worked through around the, and then even if you did that, as I say, you know, things could change almost daily in relation to the landlord issue. And that's one of the issues we've had in gathering this space. So I appreciate that it's a movable feast and we will rely a lot on intelligence and our own database and how quickly we can respond to changes in that.
Councillor Parsons.
Can I come up on one point about the cycle in which we get to scrutinise this when it gets to what I presume will be our final stage with this already? And I just want to flag it in advance. And it's a common theme here that we'll see a complex paper 3 days before the meeting when it's going to be passed. We'll have had it for 10 days to go through what's acceptable issue. And if we mess up the work plan, we'll get it on the same night that we've got the local plan, saving the universe, and four other things that will make life very difficult for us to give it suitable time and attention when it reaches the final stages. So is there a way we can ensure that in the work programme, we ask our friends on housing and regulatory, that they make sure they get it first and they've made sure it's good before it arrives here for the time, because otherwise we'll see it may not get the attention it deserves because we get to discuss it 3 days before the meeting. Any issues arise from that, we're going to be floundering before cabinet.
We'll have to have a look at it because obviously with those meetings only being kind of once a quarter, it's whether they've got a meeting scheduled when this document becomes available. But if we can have a look at that and see if we can.
Well, vice versa, we need to ensure the document becomes available to fit the cycle we request.
Councillor Jacob.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Just following up on from Councillor Parsons on our work programme later on. There's an opportunity there to call the results of the consultation back in, but timings of the other meeting, as has been said, would be an issue. Just going back, a lot of these things we're now discussing, we'll be looking at with the next part of this, won't we, which has been said already. And we've got 70-odd councils that's already doing this. So enforcement, surely we don't need to invent the wheel. We go back and we find out what, and we get the best practice from those 70-odd councils, and that should help us a lot. So if we're moving on to the recommendations, Chair.
Yeah, I'm happy to if everybody answers.
Rather than note the proposals, I think we should welcome some sort of wording that we're finally coming to some sort of conclusion on this matter. It's been 5 years. So I think more than note, I think, would be welcome. But apart from that, I agree with the other recommendations, Chair.
That's fine. Right, shall we move on to the recommendations?
Mm-hmm.
Is everyone in support of the recommendations in the document?
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, like you say, I think we definitely word it, Sally, so that we say that we welcome it and recognise the work that's gone into it so far as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so moving on to item 7C. We've got the design supplementary planning document, Richard Bennett.
Mark Fenwick, I'm the TD for National Built Environment.
Thank you, welcome.
Thank you, Chair. Richard Bennett, Head of Planning and Regeneration. Councillor Morgan asked if I'd present this item tonight, so unfortunately is unable to attend. Members, you may recall that the Council's development plan contains a number of policies that seek to secure high-quality design places, and that's a key component of the Council's core strategy document. In order to assist the public and those people wanting to submit residential planning applications, we committed through our local development scheme in March 2019, and earlier than that indeed, to update our supplementary planning document on design in order to provide guidance and advice on how to meet those development plan policies. So therefore, work commenced and a formal process has been followed, including stakeholder workshops and public consultation, as outlined in the report before you tonight. And 23 representations were received and amendments were made to the supplementary planning document as detailed in Part B of your report. So the revised supplementary plan document is held in the appendix to the report, and Cabinet are invited to approve it as a material consideration in future planning decisions. So very happy to receive any questions that members might have. If there are any technical questions, I have my phone friend here, Mr. Bang, who does a significant amount of work in preparing the document.
Thank you. Questions? Councillor Parsons?
I just have one. Is there room and wiggle room in there? I don't mean this in the TV sense, but someone comes along into our world with grand designs or something innovative in terms of small units, affordable. Do we have scope in here to allow for that, or will this overlay it and just give somebody no chance of being more innovative in terms of something which is new, original? At either end of the grand scale, be it one off glass wooden mansion or whatever, or the small IKEA prefabricated building got on a pocket of land that we can get 7 houses in or 7 apartments. Will this negate in terms of the finishes view or will we have room for that?
Okay.
Through you, Chair, and Mark may want to come in on this. I think this is intended to be guidance to help applicants interpret what we consider to be high quality design. It's not intended to be be all and end all. I believe there is room for receiving innovative designs which push the boundaries, but each application is considered on its own merits against that policy framework. So a lot of what this document is talking about is the general type of applications that we receive on a day-to-day basis. Do you want to come in, Mark?
Yeah, I don't think much to add, Richard. I think you're right. It isn't there to stifle innovation. It's in there in a way almost to promote that. Innovation normally brings good design with it, so you wouldn't necessarily stop that. But I think what we need to protect against is bland design. There's nothing in there that would prevent the types of development that you're talking about. What you would do is make sure that they're located in the right places and they fit with the character of that area. So it might be that there are certain places that you want to put them,
but it wouldn't stifle the design, that sort of design in the first place.
You just alluded to it slightly where I was, my train of thought was heading about bland design. I think it would get much coverage of that. Obviously, on the larger housing schemes, the 10 plus, there's a lot of detail in there about streetscape, etc.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of detail about the fact that the large builders just build square boxes with not a lot of character or thought into their design at all. Is there a way of getting around that? Because obviously on the large developments, they stick to about three designs and that's about it.
Again, through you, Chair, I'll have a crack at that first. I think the developers of larger schemes tend to have their own in-house design professionals, and we would work with those types of developer through a pre-application process to help shape inputs into their designs and help shape their planning application before it's actually submitted. Where there is a difference of opinion between our in-house design experts and the applicant, we have requirements in our policies to submit the design to an independent design review. So there is an opportunity to shape design and to police it and to try and achieve the kind of design that we expect to see in Charnwood for the future. Do you want to add anything more to that?
It's probably not an awful lot to add, Richard, I don't think. It is. I think that's probably the most challenging. The national house builders are the most challenging. I think we can do an awful lot in terms of trying to create a better place, but to get them to move away from their standard house types, it's very, very difficult. Part of it is their business model is set up to deliver that. But I think there are things in here that means we can start to push the boundaries with them. But you know, in terms of the level of success, that is a difficult nut to crack.
Just do a follow-up to that. I suppose the point I was getting to is that the document is perhaps more focused at the smaller builder or the individual sort of householder type applications and individual dwellings than the bigger schemes that you were alluding to, because there are the mechanisms that we use to manage and encourage those developers to create better quality designs. So that's
what I was getting
at. Sorry.
Councillor Bolton?
I live in an area that my house was built 20 years ago. There are local ones that were built 8 to 10 years ago by different large developers. And I actually find that they are quite innovative in the design of the houses. So my road has 14 houses, there are 5 different designs of houses on the road. But apart from that, to me, it's not just about the look of the house, it's actually what they do with, you know, the green space and those areas around.
The landscaping,
that, all of the landscaping I think my concern is that where I am, we have a huge amount of green space, and I don't want to say that too loudly, just in case. Just look at me a house later. But on Grange Park, which is a much newer area, it's a little bit like an urban desert. There is very little green. I mean, there are some parks, but little space between the houses, no front gardens, none of the things that I think make a really nice community. So I just think those are things that could be.
Grange Park, for example, is a scheme that was designed back in the early 2000s, and I think it's fair to say that people's expectations around design and place have improved and changed over that time, and we've learned a lot of lessons about how to create better design, and indeed the planning systems made it easier for us to secure better design because of the public's expectations. So there are developments being brought forward today which were approved sort of 5 years ago. We have moved on in time, and this document's all about setting out our standard for the future as we move forward. So the child of this document, the children of this document, will be realised over the next 5-year period. So you're right that, you know, there are estates built during the early 2000s, mid 2000s, which, you know, were of their time, and we're in a different time now.
Thank you.
Yep.
Hi. I actually have a question along the same lines. Now, in July 2019, BBC published actually a very interesting study that if every household in the UK plants 2 trees, then we may cover approximately 3% of the trees needed by 2050. trees needed means actually to reach a net zero emissions. Now, this is actually a very scary number. And that's a lovely report, but can you please explain to me how we're going to promote more trees in the area?
There is a section in the document about trees, for pages on, but it does talk about how we will try and procure planting of trees, particularly street trees, in new developments. I think a design guide can have a limited impact in terms of delivering trees, because trees can be delivered in a numerous amount of way. And I think it's something else that we need to look at in terms of trying to develop some sort of strategy for how we deal with trees across the borough. I think the design guide can promote certain situations, but I think it needs to be taken on board by a wider group of organisations, the Highway Authority, for instance, public parks and open spaces, which sort of fall outside some of the guidance that's in here, if we're going to deliver the number of trees that you're talking about. But I think the document does reference trees, and it does explain how we will try and push that agenda forward as far as new development's concerned, but I think there's a bigger picture there that we need to consider.
Thank you, Chair. Through you, and just following up from what Mark has said, I think if we were to set a standard in here for so many trees per house, that would be going beyond the remit of what this document can do, which is just to provide guidance. So I think it's something that we are looking at as part of the new local plan to see whether we can have a policy which sets a standard like that as part of our strategy towards adapting to climate change. So watch this space.
Thank you.
On the trees, it's not just about planting the trees, it's actually about having the trees looked after once they've been planted. Because again, to use Grange Park as an example, there's about 50 trees that were planted on Grange Park that just died, sort of saplings. So some of it was a little bit of vandalism, but a lot of it was just they weren't being watered over the summer. So it's, you know, to me, it's not just about we're going to plant 100,000 trees or whatever the figure is. It should be about by a certain date we're going to have a net increase in trees of 100,000. But also developers and residents really must start to look after the green space.
Okay.
I go out with my watering can.
I've just got a couple of questions. Just on as an overall basis, do we think that the design document is going to help with planning decisions and make them more efficient going forward?
I think so, Chair. I mean, one of the important parts of this document is it lays it out on the table, not just for officers for consistent decision making, but also for members of the public to understand what the expectations are. You know, what's the Charnwood standard? Well, it's set out in this document. So I think that's going to be helpful, and I think it will make a difference.
Do you think it will be time, financial savings, but both? I mean, I guess if it's using less officer time, then it is essentially saving us money.
Will it save any money in making decisions? Officers are professional, professionally trained. They have a lot of this stuff in their heads as part of their sort of day-to-day work anyway. I think it's just helpful to get it on, it, you know, down on a piece of paper, so that it's consistent and it supports a reference. But I think the important role that it has is to say to the people outside, your residents and developers, that this is what we're expecting, and this is this is the currency that we're playing with when you come and talk to Charlie.
Okay. Anyone got any further questions? Councillor Parsons.
I have just one. On page 139, sorry again, on paper, point 7, it just says, and again, it's probably something I've missed, but you might be able to point it to me. It just says the representations received informed a number of changes to the SPD, including the following minor changes, greater recognition of neighbourhood plans. Is that referenced anywhere in here, the neighbourhood plans point? Because we've had one neighbourhood plan, is that Thurmaston, where we've had one neighbourhood plan passed?
Thurmaston
have done neighbourhood plan. Now, it's not something we put great emphasis on.
There's more coming through.
There's quite a few, I think,
Barrow.
Possibly
Rothley
as well now.
Is there a reference in here to what the ASIS has done in the document?
Say that.
Sorry, I'm not quite sure I followed the question. Councillor Parsons.
Yeah, sorry. It says that after the consultation, it says the representations received informed a number of changes to the SPD, including the following minor changes, greater recognition of neighbourhood plans. And I was just trying to go through the document to see where that was in the plan. I couldn't find it. And it's probably me reading, trying to find neighbourhood plans and bits. I was just wanting to know what we did about that, because I've been loosely attached to the neighbourhood planning process.
Sure.
And worked with a ward that's thinking about it.
Through you, Chair. Members may have noticed that there is a neighbourhood plan on the agenda of Cabinet on the 16th. That's the Salvey neighbourhood plan. I believe it's the fifth one that Council's been asked to adopt. I think the point that's been made there is that neighbourhood plans often have reference to design in their own policies to reflect the local vernacular. And it's just making sure that where neighbourhood plans have set out what's uniquely special about those particular areas, that's been captured in the advice that's given in the design SPD, so it's not lost. So you may have noticed that whilst it's not a neighbourhood plan, the thing that I noticed while I was sat waiting for this item to come up was around the village design statement, which is another advisory document that some of our communities have prepared over the years. But there's a reference to, I can't remember which one it was, is it Seagrave, as a particular exemplar of a certain type of way of dealing with a design issue. So that's really the point. It's just that where neighbourhood plans have made a particular point about design, what's good in a particular area, that's captured in the advice, and that it's consistent, I think.
Okay. Any further questions?